everybody. Hello, nice to see so many faces. It's also a bit intimidating to see so many faces, but my name is Linda Geraghty. I'm with Branner Mehel CPS, which is a pilot artist support scheme that is funded by the Arts Council. And today's panel discussion is towards sustainability, so exploring and looking at models of support for independent artists. We are delighted to have a range of expertise on the panel and in the room here today. So just to set out, I suppose the invitation for this discussion is very much a discussion, and we'd really love to have a back and forth conversation, for it to be a conversation in the room about everybody's experiences, your thoughts, your opinions, and to have that interaction. So we kind of love it to be more of a conversation. It'll be a very large conversation. Once everybody has kind of introduced themselves and set out their context, it'd be really good to start that open discussion. So just to set that out from the beginning, that we'd love to hear from anybody at any point. I'd love to introduce our panel here today. We have artists Dan Colley and Matt Smith, who are here to speak to their model basically over the last number of years. They've recently created the wonderful Very Own Man with Enormous Wings. And their journey is really interesting, kind of how they have got from A to Z, I suppose.
The end.
We have Emer McGowan from Drake in Blanchardstown, and as I referred to earlier on, the queen of artist supports of venues in the country. But Emer is here to kind of speak to that model within venues that exists in the country as well, of around residencies. She's worked in the sector for many, many years and has supported many people in that time. We have Kate Cross from the Egg in Bath, who's also kind of going to speak to the artist supports that she has experienced and the work that has come out of that. And Tony Rickey from Catherine Wheels in Edinburgh as well, who has the model, I suppose, of producing work and also supporting artists. And I know these people need no introduction with the people in the room here as well, but just to set that out from the beginning. So I suppose just to kick things off, Dan and Matt, could you tell us your story and how you've got to the end?
One of the genuinely interesting bits, only like two or three. For those of you who don't know, I'm Matt and this is Dan, and we had a show that was a relative success about 10 years ago, 10 or 11 years ago, called Monster Clock. And then we kind of formed a company around that because we started touring it, and we became more of a collective and started doing like grown-up things like getting a bank account and applying to the CRO and finding out what Arts Council funding is, and then we had a company which was Matt, and then we had like loads of people who were like incredibly supportive. Initially the Civic, who told us about artist residencies, and then the venues that we toured around that show, and then started thinking about making another show, and then the company started to grow into like this other thing, like a company that we kind of had to feed, and a company that we hit a point where someone said to us, I think it was maybe Willie White or someone, like, oh, most companies finish up after like two or three shows. You know, you'll hit a point where you're not that interested in each other anymore, and you know, you'll go your separate ways. And we had that in our head, and we're like, you never want Willie to be right. So you're like, oh, okay, we have to like get over this hump.
That third show was really bad.
Push
through.
Yeah, we just didn't invite him. So we made like a year budget, because we love doing budgets, and we made a year budget of like, okay, so we have no money, but actually if we spend loads more money, we can kind of like stay together long and start to fundraise for this kind of ideal of what it would be for us to work on all these things. And then from there we kind of started to like think of other projects the company could do that wasn't making plays that would start to sustain it.
Yeah, and I think for a while there we were sort of the sustainability, and as far as we had it, was in the variety of things. So like we made theatre for young audiences, we made theatre for not young audiences, we ran a comedy festival, we platformed other comedy, we did sort of puppet comedy, we did we had like a friend scheme, we had residencies in the Civic, and then for 3 years in Drake, and then towards the end in the Riverbank, which continues on in different guise now. And
we set up a podcast.
It was crazy.
We bring companies over from the UK to play.
It was too much.
We always say like, like, yeah. Is the idea a good idea that we want to do, or should we just go work in a shop and that will actually be the same amount of money with less like stress and hassle? So that was our kind of barometer of like whether we're going to do something or not. And what it lent itself to, like, we had a brilliant time and we enjoyed all the mad stuff we tried to keep the company going. But it was as we all kind of grew a bit older and our tastes and interests started to change, the artistic thread started to kind of wear a bit thin, and you know, we started talking about different things, and an idea would come from one artist to the company because it was three artists and two producers, four artists and two producers.
Yeah, but mostly me and Owen were the sort of people who were mostly making. Yeah,
and every time an idea would come to the company, it would become a bit more like, oh, maybe, instead of like a whole artist, yes, let's do this. So then we started talking about like a what's a good exit. You know, we've had this company for 10 years and we all kind of want to try different things. Maybe one person should keep it going and the others kind of leave and pursue their other things, or maybe we should just let it be where it is, or should we keep it going? Should we try and find a new thing? And it was like a really kind of good, we didn't have any moderators or anything like that. We just kept meeting up once a week for a couple of months trying to figure out what's the best next step.
Yeah, we did our own couples therapy, really.
This is an interesting thing, I guess, and it speaks to kind of your model. You had each other, and you had the company structure, and that. And I suppose it's the question of what is sustainability and what does it look like. Yeah. And you had to, I suppose, jump through many hoops and different guises to keep it going, and reached a point where you're asking all the questions over at the end of 10 years. But you had that connection, I suppose, to back and forth.
Yeah, we did a couple of things early on. Like, we pulled together a board of like brilliant people that we had no right to ask to be on like our board, and we didn't even also know what a board is. And I see Lally in the audience there, and she was one of them. We used to call them godparents because we were so allergic to
company stuff.
Which is why I think Owen was Time Lord on the accounts, because you could fill in like your own role other than treasurer or chairperson.
He was Time Lord
on Ulster Bank. That's what happened to Ulster Bank in the end. So, and the board were brilliant because they helped us push ourselves, push each other in different directions, and they held the space for us, and we wrote loads of different strategies and straw men. Remember that thing with all the different ideas about what the company could be? Yeah. And we'd always think about other companies that were as confusing as us that we liked. So people like Hen's Teeth, who some of you dubs might know is a restaurant now, but like even before that they were an even more confusing entity of like brand and parties and clothes. I think they were clothes, and we were like, we like their vibe, but it's really confusing what they do, and I think people say that about us. So we'd start trying to figure out how they did it and what we should do, but in the end we started to exit, and it worked out. It was useful that we had just made Dan had just made A Very Old Man with Riverbank while we were in residence there, and that was going to end up being our last show, because then it went to the Fringe and then was invited to play in the Peacock in the Abbey. So it felt good because we were going out on a high, and we got to, you know, put a party around it and invite all our former collaborators and donors and board members, but also because people wanted the show to go on afterwards, and it had been invited to a bunch of things like Summer Hall in Edinburgh. It didn't feel like it was over for some of the artistic part of it, and it felt that it was a good start for lots of people to start the next step of their career, which was great.
Brilliant. Well, we might come back to that idea of kind of having had the company and then moved into the back into the independent sphere shortly. We might move on to you, Emer, just to set out your stall and kind of where you're coming from within the
So I do know quite a number of people in the audience, and I've worked with quite a number, which I think is a testament to the work that Drake does in this particular space. So my name is Emer. I run Draked, which is an art centre based in Dublin 15. There's a population of 130,000. We have the youngest demographic of any local authority area in the country, and we also have double the national average of people who have come in from different places, i.e. outside the country. So we have a very particular demographic, and I suppose we've always looked to that. The children and young, you know, we have a particular commitment to children and young people. We always have. When I started in Draked, which is a very long time ago, like really, it's a very long time ago, 21 years. I was the outreach education officer before I was appointed director. And I had a career up to that point where I had always worked in that particular area. I had worked in Dublin Youth Theatre, Team Educational Theatre Company. I had worked as a youth arts officer in a youth work organisation. I had run Babero. I'd worked for NYD. So, you know, run the NYT, the, you know, loads of stuff. So I came with a very particular commitment to children and to young people personally. And then once I knew of the demographic of Dublin 15, I thought, this is a win-win. This is where I belong. And once I took over director, the first thing I did was that I actually focused the role of outreach education officer into a children youth arts officer. We are still the only venue that has that role in the country. There are 42 venues funded in the arts through the Arts Council's funding program. But I think, Orla, you didn't have that role in the Linen Hall, but your role was broader, was it?
Yeah,
it's broader than that. Yeah. So I think DREAT is the only art centre in the country that has a children youth arts officer. And that is really significant. And from next year, we are probably going to be the only art centre that has an EDI officer as well. So I'm pretty proud of that. So the last 21 years, we have supported many artists at many points of their career. And if somebody, because I know this is around looking at models of support, if somebody asked me how would they, you know, an artist maybe starting out at the beginning of their career, and I know people here at very different stages of that, you know, I would say the first thing, like these two guys on the left, is to ask, you know. The first thing you need to do is ask, you know. And the second thing you really need to do is to build a relationship, you know. Like the first time that I saw these guys was when they brought out Monster Clock, and there was pretty much a buzz. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
There was a buzz. I can't remember what year that was.
12 or 13.
Maybe. Was it 12 or 13? Yeah, there was a lot of buzz about Monster Clock when it came out because it was something that was really ambitious. There was a group of recent enough graduates, and they were trying something else, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, many of us went to see the work, and then you did play in Drake. You came to Drake with that show. So that was probably the first time that we met. And I suppose one of the things for me that I always say to people is that the arts are relational and they are durational. We are here for the long haul. Drake as an organisation is here for the long haul. We are not going anywhere. I may go eventually. Someone else, I have written in our strategy that children or young people are embedded, you know, so even when I, you know, go eventually to live my life in France or wherever, you know, Drift is always going to have that particular commitment because of the demographic of the area.
That's an interesting point, Tim, where I think around sustainability as well. The sustainability of support is that writing it into your strategy, writing it into the legacy of the venue, and kind of you see that shift in personnel where when people have a particular role for work for young audiences and invest in that, and then when that person leaves, that there is a, you know, that there is a, an ingrained legacy in it, and that the relationships and the support continue with that venue, even if the key contact has moved on or whatever to retire to South France.
No, absolutely. And actually, it is one of the things that's on my list. I am wondering a bit, but actually, every venue in the country has to have a strategy. You know, if you're going to get Arts Council funding, we have to have a strategy. And even though it might be a little bit painful to read some of them, I would say if you're going to go to a venue and ask for something or have that conversation, you really should be aware of what their priorities are. I mean, that would be, you know, that is key. You know, now many of us speak to the Arts Council's Making Great Art Work. You know, the Arts Council's 10-year policy, which is up in 2025. But really, for a venue, I mean, the two tenets of that is, you know, you support artists and you provide for public engagement. And you're like, you might as well just go equals venue. Do you know, that's what we do. That's our bread and butter. So in terms of the supports, the type of supports that we can give. I think if I was an artist, which I'm not, but if I was an artist starting out, I think one of the first things I would do is that I would look out for gap days. Do you guys know about gap days? So I think apply for gap day through the Mermaid. And what the gap day does is that it will hook you into your local venue. And as part of that day, which is a paid day, you get a fee, an artist gets a fee for that. The venue director has to meet you for lunch or for coffee, you know? So that's part of the, you know, that's part of the contract between, you know, venue hosts and the gap day organizers, you know? So actually you need to have cups of coffee, you know, you need to sit down, you need to have a chat, you need to go, hello, this is who I am, this is the type of work I'm interested in. If you're local to that venue, that's even better, because that's tick tick. We're all about the local, you know. There are 42 of us, so you know, we're very keen on supporting our local artists. Then I might go in and go, is there any chance you give me space? Do you know, any chance, give me a room for a few days, I might come in and, you know, do a bit of prep. And then you get in, and then you might have another cup of coffee. And then you might have conversations about, you know, the kind of work you're interested in. You might have a show coming out. You might ask them to take your show. They may pay you a guarantee, which is one of the other supports that we give. And it is all about those layering of conversations, of work, of getting to know each other, getting to know what type of work the person's interested in and what is possible for each venue. Drake, in some way, is probably a little unusual, maybe, in terms of just the amount of supports that we give. So in terms of benefit and kind, we would give out between, you know, last year was €82,105. I know, because I do my Arts Council applications, worth of benefit and kind support. And that's space, admin, tech, mentoring, all kinds of stuff. That's a significant investment in artist work that really goes pretty much under the radar, you know. We Dreact does quite a lot of residencies. Jess isn't here, but Jess Raoul, who's on the Metal Programme, she's just finishing up a 3-year residency. Paul Curley's our theatre artist in residence at the moment. He's for 2 years, maybe more. And a new Matt, when he takes off that hat and he puts on another hat, our company in residence. So I love them, residency. And actually the Arts Council also love residencies. They have told me that that's what they like art centres to do. They like art centres to do residencies with artists, because it gives you guys a sustained period of time to develop work, to develop relationships. So they're very keen on that. They're less keen on bursaries. They really like residencies. And Dreact has done so many over the years. And they're really key to what we do, I have to say. They're really useful. And sometimes what comes out of that is commissions. So we do quite a lot of commissions as well. So we did commission Paul Curley and Derek Clancy to produce a new show called Grey Matter, which actually had a work in progress here last year. We commissioned Monica to do a piece called Connect the Dots as well. We commissioned visual artists to do work for our galleries. So we do commission quite a lot. There are venue networks. Dreact is part of 3. One of them is a network called the Network for Extraordinary Audiences. And that is different to the others in that that is about supporting one particular artist. So it's a really interesting model to look at. And that is Anna Newell, because Anna, as some of you may know, Anna's work, but she works with little ones, like tiny, tiny, tiny kids, 0 to 2, and then children with complex needs. What else do we do? We have a residency with the Centre Culturel Irlandais. And we do that every year. So Liam is going over very shortly. I'm going to give him my top tips, what to do in Paris. And Paul will be going over there next year, I think in June. How lovely. And I think we've done 5 to date, and that's something, just find that space for an artist to go away and be somewhere beautiful, and pink is really nice. Like, I can keep going.
I'll stop you there. It's a wonderful introduction to the breadth of what Drake is doing and the different potentials and opportunities that are there. But I'll go back to Monica's connecting the dots. And that is really, I suppose, what we want to kind of get the conversation going about today, because the Branners Mental CPS, I suppose, that pilot scheme that's supported by the Arts Council is looking at ways that we connect those dots and kind of connect the work that's going on at venues, the funding that's coming from the Arts Council, who are in the room over here, by the way, which is why I keep looking over there when I say Arts Council, and the artists and the residency schemes. There is a lot happening independently in the country right now, and there's a swell of support, I feel, towards raising the sector, kind of having that cohesive sector for work for young audiences in Ireland right now. And it feels like a moment. I know there's been so much work done over the last 20 plus years, but what it feels like right now is that there is kind of funded support for it to happen, and there's structures that kind of can connect the dots and bring people together, and there's power in numbers. And I think that's a real opportunity for everyone to collectively work together, I suppose, to push the sector forward, to look for ways to support artists and career paths and sustainable career paths for artists. And I think kind of listening to the conversation so far kind of shows how much opportunity is out there. And I think Eimear's right about that. The trust and the relationships, and sometimes it feels like that's a big bridge to gap and to open that door. And how do you get that relationship started? But I guess it is about the conversation, the coffee and the start, and then finding out kind of what's available and what way you can find that stepping stone to the next project or the next the next thing that keeps you going. So Eimear, thank you for that. Kate, do you want to hop in there and tell us about life in Bath at the A and the work that you have been doing in this vein in your part of the world?
I don't know whether I'm going to sort of like give a sort of blow by blow account of what we do, but I might. I always find myself talking about how we do things rather than what we do. Mm-hmm. But just for sort of context, our artist development program at the Egg in Bath, which is a venue, and it's a venue dedicated to making work and presenting work for children and young audiences. And so that sort of automatically led us to not just programming work, but producing work. And that automatically led us to working with artists. So that got us into the space of philosophical thinking about what that could look like. And so we set up our artist development scheme called the Incubator. And as time went on during that incubator, when we were working with artists, we stopped calling it an artist development program and we started to call it an idea development program, because we found ourselves inviting ideas and being driven by the idea as much as the artist, and supporting the artist to make the idea and to bring the idea to fruition as much as possible. I sort of wrote a little narrative. Actually, I'm not going to read it, but I'm just going to kind of talk you through the narrative of what our sort of philosophy is and how that's kind of underpinned some of the work that we've been doing. So when a former producer at the Egg started working with us a few years ago, apparently I said to him, right, you've just got one job, and that's not to make any shit theatre for young audiences. I don't actually remember saying that, but I don't remember much these days, but it seems fairly plausible. So we set about trying to figure out how not to make shit theatre, or what makes shit theatre. So anyway, let me backpedal a bit more than that, because I, like many, many of us here, have had 20 odd years of privilege of being able to watch thousands of children watch plays. And we learn from that. You know, I've learned an awful lot from just watching those young people watch those plays and really, really sort of studying them and observing them. It might be kind of quasi-psychology, but I feel as though I've learned. I feel as though I know the difference between a false laugh and a really strong human connection. I feel as though I know the difference, or I can sense the difference between boredom and some kind of harnessed fidgeting, which is what I'm doing now to help me focus on talking to all of you.
I dare to imagine when I'm in that space, that short time inside an auditorium, and that's a kind of metaphor for any space where we gather, that everyone is equal. Anyone can connect with the art, the content, and one another. And in that golden space, I dare to imagine that experience and intelligence, poverty and privilege, they don't have to be a thing in that space. And that thing that is bigger than the fuck up that is society is the most hopeful thing of all, and that is as us being human beings and the experience of being human together. And whoever we are and wherever we come from, we have that crazy thing in common. So I also started to see a mismatch in my audiences between adult and child expectations of the work. I became suspicious that what parents and teachers thought the children should be seeing was starting to dominate the making of the work and starting to dominate the selection of the work. And of course, there's not a wealth of differences there between a parent or a teacher as a ticket buyer and a funder in terms of pulling those strings. And so I feel as though if we're not careful, those, let's call them funders in all of their various guises, will start to pull our strings so much that the artist or the child in the auditorium doesn't get a look in. And they'll pull our strings so that the naughty problem of being human is lost in a sea of kind of social, educational, moral, or even socially climbing imperatives. They've become the maker. So in this fundraising circus, no one is asking the artist what they want to communicate. What's burning them up? What's your fascination? What's the thing you just keep circling around over and over and over again? And I've met artists who don't even know the answer to that question, who are not yet brave enough to be vulnerable and flawed in front of a young audience and questioning and not knowing answers. They're very, very busy doing the right thing, but they're not busy listening to themselves. So through working with artists, through perseverance, through time, through good conditions, through paying audiences, actually, there's nothing better for an artist than a paying audience, I think, for focusing the mind, and through scheduled space for some fuck-ups, eventually the weight can lift, a door can open, and the artist can revisit themselves, and they start to learn how to give themselves space in their work and to value themselves and to give weight and meaning to their voice. And then the producers and funders can set about making it relevant and efficient and sustainable and fair, the producers. That does matter to us, so long as where the art is concerned is an afterthought and not the main thought. So my somewhat unfashionable and off-kilter manifesto for making this work sustainable is to let artists be artists and allow producers to produce artfully and sustainably, whatever that means in the moment. And for funders to simplify funding applications and to entertain the shocking notion that art, when it is free, truly free, can speak to anyone, and that that alone can change things. So that's my manifesto.
Beautifully said, Kate. Thank you for that. Thanks for bringing that to the room.
That's a hard one to follow, Tony.
Thanks, I'm just going to take Kate's notes.
I'm
going to turn around slightly because I get the feeling that there's people over that side are just making faces at me. You don't actually see them.
It's Joanna Merck.
I don't know if you quite follow that really. I'm just suddenly thinking, God, I should have taken notes as well. And it was something, oh, just got Kate to do my notes instead. So I'm Tony Rickey. I'm from Catherine Mills Theatre Company. It's a company based in East Lothian in Scotland. And our company has always supported artists in lots of ways, and in some ways quite a traditional tour and theatre company for children and young people, but it's always had a tradition of supporting other artists out with that sort of core artistic team that the company had. What I think really, really changed for us is, and I always have to be careful the way that I say this, was that the pandemic was really quite positive for us in a lot of ways. Obviously, it wasn't very positive in lots and lots and lots of other ways. But what it did for us as an organisation is it really, really gave us an opportunity to think about what we were as a company, what we were in relationship to the rest of the community that we were in, what was the point of us, and what could we be in terms of trying to shift from looking at ourselves as being this artistic company and actually seeing ourselves as being a sort of broader resource that was actually about working with the community in its broadest sense to get to that place of not making shit theatre or trying to make work which was as good as it possibly could be for the broadest possible range of children in East Lothian and then Scotland. So starting to be in that place was actually really useful to start to go on a journey. What you have with something like Methyl is you actually have quite a sort of, you have a coherent program of looking at work, which is actually about supporting artists. We kind of went on a more sort of vague and incoherent journey. But at the same time, over that period of 3 years, have supported about and worked with about 18 artists. Our approach to that was rather than, it started off in quite a traditional way. It was people just coming to us with ideas. Like a lot of people, what we did was, how do we support freelancers? It's the start of the pandemic. What are we going to do? People started to come up with variations on, send us ideas and we'll give you some money. And the government's going to give us some money and we're just going to give you some money and then you're going to work on an idea for a while. So we did that and we called it Make Space. And we got 5 ideas. Let's go back to that thing about ideas rather than... And they were artists, sometimes individuals or groups of individuals. And then over a year, they would work on their idea. We quickly got into that thing about actually then questioning what we were as a company. And we're producers, we make work. So the idea of people just coming in and just playing with an idea for a while was kind of fine in itself, but we actually wanted to talk to people about going, how far can you take this idea within the context of the amount of work, amount of money that's actually available? And the great thing about it was each one of those 5 ideas went through to completion in some shape or form. So either they went through to the point where this is where it was finished. Some of them went on to the point where it then was then developed and then got extra funding so they could take it and develop it and move it. But all those ideas ended up, one of them ended up at the Children's Festival, Noel. So there was lots and lots of different stuff that was actually going on. And it made us start to question about what was our role and what do we need to be doing as a company and as a resource to respond to the needs of artists and their development with ideas and the discussions that they were having, sort of like moving along. So there's a couple of things in a sense that started happening. The great thing about this is it's an ongoing discussion. It's a never-ending discussion because it starts to talk about lots and lots of things about who holds the power, who holds the funding, and if it's going to be companies like ours, why are we holding the funding? What does that mean? And then what does that mean about the relationship that you actually need to start having with people? Because the other thing that we learned through the pandemic was that we actually have to look after people a hell of a lot better than we were ever looking after people before. So there's a couple of things I'm just going to like throw in about where our journey is at the moment. One of the things we do now before anybody comes to work with us is that we give them a code of care document. This was something that was set up by the Spark Arts, the Spark Arts Festival in Leicester. It came from that place which was about Me Too. It came from that place which was about diversity. It came from that place about how are you getting people into the room who were never ever invited into the room and all the barriers that are in place that stop people getting in there. But ultimately what the Code of Care document is about trying to start off the relationship in an equal footing. It's trying as much as possible, still understanding that there are inequalities there, because in a sense we're still the ones that are holding the funds, but trying to get that relationship back to a place where you're starting off from an equal place. It's up to the person who gets this document to use it in any way they want. They can just go, that's lovely, and that's more paperwork that I just don't need to actually look at. They can, however, then go into it and say, because it's a template, it's about saying, this is who I am. This is the kind of artist I am. This is how I work best. These are the conditions that I work best. This is my experience. Therefore, this is how much you need to pay me. I am good at working in the mornings. I am shit at working in the mornings because I have children or I have somebody that I care for, or I am generally shit in the morning because I've been up in the middle of the night sacrificing a goat. Everybody has, it's that thing about actually going, people are individuals. And so what you need to do is stop doing that thing that companies do a lot of the time of saying, here's the contract. You fill in the contract, you respond to the contract, and then you work for the company in the way that we want you to work for them. Because people, we need to move forward from that, and we need to move on from that. So the code of care is there. It's actually something that we share. I know the Spark Arts for Children came up with that. It's something which is there to be shared for anybody and used by anybody as well. And for freelancers on this journey, I think it's sometimes just quite a useful thing to have for yourself, just to go, this is who I am. It's great from that diversity point as well, because it actually does that thing about saying, this is who I identify as, which can sometimes be really, really important as well. But also that thing about, just because I identify as that kind of thing does not mean I am the spokesperson for everybody else who is that kind of thing that I identify for. And it just tries to get that sort of nuanced discussion going as a starting off point. The only other thing I would just say as well is that the journey that we're on is really, really starting to make us question what we are as a company and how we can best serve the community that we live in and that we're part of. And what that means is, for us going on that journey with those artists at the moment that we're working with and we will continue to work with, and trying to get beyond that point that happens, that when you do R&D and you do development with people up to a certain point, what happens is that point then stops, and then you go, right, off you go and get funding for that. And we know how difficult that is. And so what we're seeing now and what we're going to put into practice over the next couple of years is that the artists that we're working with now, they are going to be making our shows in the next couple of years. And so we're going to take them through that full process using what we are and what we recognise as the things that we can support them with as a company in terms of space, in terms of physical space, in terms of resources, and all the people that we have at Catherine Wheels to allow them to not make shit work. That's me.
Thank you, Johnny. That's great. And I think it's a very interesting point. And I think what's coming through with everybody here is around the generosity of sharing and the openness to kind of collaborating and working with artists. And Tony, what you talked about there in the power balances, I think is a really interesting thing to think about, and I think for everyone to reflect on, because it takes that kind of reflection and that consideration of what does it mean if you're holding the funding or you can access that funding if you have those structures around you and have that power then to bring things forward. And I think it's really interesting to hear about the generosity as well of opening your company out to other artists to tap into that. And I suppose it's something that Branner have done for years as well with the tiny shows and has now morphed into Metal, and kind of seeing how that grows and how that can support so many artists to make work kind of from an early stage of idea into completion. And I think that is really good, and that code of care document is certainly a good idea to help that communication piece and to allow relationships to develop. So at this point, again, going back to what we'd like to do is have that conversation going, and we'd love to open it out to everybody in the room to maybe ask questions, comments, or kind of just talk to the panel here around kind of dreaming up, I suppose, the ideal scenario. What does sustainability look like to you as an individual artist or practitioner or producer? Do you know, what is it that is
is exists for you or doesn't exist for you, or what, you know, what is that, what's the ideal scenario, I suppose, just to dream a little bit around what could the future look like in an ideal situation, and how do we get there if there is that collective generosity and there is that kind of funding support to do these things, and how do we connect the dots to bring people together to rise all the boats. So if they're Lally there. Thank you.
I'm actually going to think of an answer, but Tony just kind of struck a chord with me because you were talking about the community that it serves. And that's something that hasn't really been mentioned too much, in the sense that it's lovely to hear what everyone is doing, but how have you worked with your community that to be at that place? You know, just to give us a little insight to the relationship you have with the community and how the community supports the work that your company does.
I suppose, yeah, I mean, I suppose everybody will have those different answers. One of our journeys is that we've stopped pre-pandemic. 65% of our work happened, was seen by children outside Scotland, which is lovely and stupid at the same time. We are an East Lothian company. That's what we are, and that's who our audience is, that's who our community is. And so again, that lovely thing about the pandemic was that it just actually made us work very, very close to home, and then go down that journey about what does it mean to be part of a community. And what it means is not parachuting in with loveliness and just saying, look at us, we're lovely, and then going away again. Because in a sense, people sometimes have that sort of slight expectation that that's what artists are like, about doing that thing, about going in there and actually saying, what is it you actually need? What is it you actually want? And can we actually be of any use with regards to that? Because we might not be, but we might know somebody that could be. Mm-hmm. So we went, we couldn't go during the pandemic, obviously we couldn't go anywhere. The school wanted a relationship with us, the local school. They wanted a relationship with us. They wanted to do a project with us. And then they came back, and so we said, so what's the idea for you? And they said, we want to do Islam. And of course, we just said, no, we can't possibly do this. And then it was actually through our relationship with Vital Spark and the Spark Arts Festival, they basically just came back and just went, you have to do it. We have to find a Muslim artist to go and work with them. And it was that thing of going, this isn't rocket science. You just actually have to stop, you know. And also that thing about going, you will make mistakes. You really, really will make mistakes. But you have to make mistakes. Make mistakes. It's what artists do. Go on the journey. And so going again, that whole thing about how you open up, find people, you know, and people do that thing about going, there's no Muslim artists out there. Yes, there are. But they just are not in the same networks and Facebook groups and all that stuff that we tend to use. So you have to really, really work hard in that sense to actually find people. And then when you do, you actually go on this really, really incredible journey where you have to step back a bit and let people go on that journey with themselves and let those artists go on that journey with the community. And then see what happens and see what actually comes up to it. And it's quite scary and sometimes because you don't know how it's going to end up. And where the arts councils get really, really freaked out by it is that you actually are saying, we're going to do this. And what's going to happen? No idea. Absolutely no idea. But something will happen, and then we'll tell you what happens at the end of it. And what happened at the end of that project was that the teacher... it still to this day can't speak about it without crying. She can't get to that place with talking about the journey that these kids went on with this Muslim writer without, you know. And for us, it was like, well, this is a journey. We're a touring theatre company. We wouldn't ever did this kind of project before, but we can because we're a resource which is about serving artists to do that kind of stuff in the community. So I'm talking way too much today.
Danny, do you, from your perspective as an artist who has kind of both worked in a community context and kind of, I suppose, in a residency context, is there anything you'd like to kind of feed into that around that what has been kind of crucial to you or what supports you've really found to allow you to kind of grow and continue to develop?
I suppose the two biggest factors really would be the residency, which, you know, which is a, you know, funded by the Arts Council, also by the local authority, also by the venue, for a series of sort of non-project based sort of things that sort of fill the gap, that allow you the time to read the book that's going to be the next show, or that little bit of extra time to tech the difficult show, so you're not doing that in the festival opening, you know, those kinds of things that give the thing a little bit more time, a little bit more resources, the things that aren't necessarily the project, but the kind of things that go into bridging the gaps that make you the kind of person who has a job that can do the projects, right? Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. And the other one is Matt Smith, actually. So that relationship is crucial. So, I mean, all through Collapsing Horse, we were making a thing. And then even when Collapsing Horse set aside, we were like, we're still doing things, right? And so that sort of continued. It's a sort of an essential understanding that even if you're looking off this direction, you're like, okay, yeah, that's there. Yeah, great. And also to keep that kind of consistency of a creative relationship going, right? Our sort of Friday evenings, like, what are you reading? What are you watching? What are you interested in? You know, to kind of formalize those and to have a kind of a pot that's seasoned all the time. Another sort of crucial aspect of the residency thing, I suppose, is also that connection to the community and to the audience. So, for example, I was working a lot with, I was developing a show in Drieck for a while that was for a teenage audience. And they've got a really strong youth theatre, youth work going on there. So I would do workshops, and they would be the kind of workshops I would do with the youth theatre anyway. But as I'm going along, I'm kind of asking questions and posing things in a way that's helpful for my understanding. And then those young people end up being the first audience for it as well, right? Same also happened in the riverbank with a very old man. I was working with young people and I was working with old people, right? So doing those workshops, it's an exchange, right? Mm-hmm. I've got a cool puppetry workshop that people love to do, right? It's very easy. Go on YouTube, actually. I stole it from there. It's Garen Gimble's workshop on the National Theatre one. It's great. But then while I'm there, I'm like, okay, let's talk about a very old man with enormous wings. Let's read this short story. What are your reactions to it? And then those things kind of get into the pot. They kind of season the thing as it's going along. And so it just bridges that gap. You know what I mean? It's not necessarily the weeks that you have your collaborators in the room or the weeks that you are in rehearsal. It's the in-between stuff, which is sort of essential. And also, like, you know, and that also allows us to be together a bit better. You know what I mean? Like, that means that, like, Matt has a fee for, like, organizing the stuff that's to do with that. But mostly it's to bridge the gap, I think, in Matt's work as well, so that it's reasonable to expect that he's not at the end of the phone all the time. I mean, if we tried to build up those hours, I don't think you'd be able to get better. But to be able to say, yeah, we're colleagues, not just for the show, but for the life.
It's kind of replaced the idea of, like, having a company as a cipher to talk about ideas, like, how about this? Like, will this work in the residency? Or here's an idea, like, an octopus opera, because you read the book and then I listened to a podcast. I'm like, okay, in my head, I'm like, that'll be a development in, like, a residency or two, like an octopus thing for kids. Yeah. That is the high level of intellect that we're dealing with here right now. There is no rigor.
I can pitch it now, though. Yeah. Actually, hold me back.
So far, people, I don't think it's a good idea.
We try to do it.
So it's become a useful, and I guess whether it's a residency or having a company or a collective, you know, I think it's on each artist or director or group of people to find what that is. It doesn't necessarily have to be these things, and you also don't necessarily have to have, like, this, you know, emerging mid-career, final career pathway ahead of you to work through. You know, the gig economy and what we all work in can be a bit cyclical, and I think people can get in their head that, like, I've done a fringe show and I'm going to do a DTF show, and then, you know, I'll be on one of the main house stages and then that'll be it for a while, maybe an international tour, when actually there's kind of a lot more of a conversation between the art centers and the festivals and potential collaborators in Ireland that you can keep going and not have to not have to make it so linear, you know?
Yeah. And it's finding the space in between, isn't it? In between projects, the supported space, the paid for space to reflect and think and consider and collaborate, I guess, rather than the project to project all the time running on the hamster wheel.
And I was, it was add one thing. I mean, often we're like, you know, wouldn't it be great to have more than 1 year's certainty or even a year's certainty, right? We say 3 years. In some ways, like, yeah, like I could tell you very vaguely the shows will do over the next 3 to 5 years or whatever. But in some sense, like, you know, we'd all love to have that. The Arts Council would love to have more than a year's certainty, you know. I think the thing that helps you sustain is a sort of a general hope, right? That there's hope that even though you don't know it's going to be there the year after next, you don't know it's going to be the year after next, there's a good sense about the place that it will, that you've got a good shot at it. And then you can be more present with what you're doing now. Mm-hmm. If you can just sort of just cultivate a community of hope, no bother to us, right? Just do that and then we'll be fine.
Do the banks listen to that with mortgages? No. Should I open that can of worms?
No, but on that, like, it is a total scam. Like, if you try to apply for a bank with a mortgage as a freelancer, they'll want 3 years of your self-assessed tax forms. But if you get a job, they want one payslip.
Yeah.
They want one, but you need to have been employed for 1 month before they're like, yeah, you're a real person. Yeah.
Mark, can we?
Can I just ask about people's experience of sustaining relationships with artists while making room for new relationships with artists? Is there any golden formula or good examples?
And I guess that's to the room as well, right?
Yeah.
No golden formula. I always describe Drake like a stone, you know, rolling down that hill or mountain or whatever, Everest, you know, where we gather people, you know. Drake has gathered people, you know, lots of people in this room, you know, I've worked with for, you know, a long time, you know, like you guys for whatever 10 years, you know, Paul Branner, you know, and other people, you know, other people have come on kind of later. Monica, you know, through various programs, we did a mentoring program for artists. Monica was on that. Selma, Lee, you know, so like we kind of gather people and then people, you know, might come to me. So I think Paul came to me about Grey Matter, actually gone, are you applying for commission for anybody? You know, but because we've had, you know, I've programmed Paul's work quite a lot over the years. I have known him. I've met him at festivals. We've hung out. We've had lots of conversations. You know, so it's about kind of maintaining those relationships. You know, but you're always open to, you know, having the conversation with the new person, with the person that you don't know. You know.
Catherine, do you?
Yeah, so I'm Catherine and I run the Children's Festival in Vancouver, Canada. And one of the ways that this has happened, not because I'm so brilliant, because other people are more brilliant than me, is I get invited to different events and festivals to speak about different things that aren't necessarily about work for kids. So in September with a Fringe Festival, I got invited to be on a panel much like this. We had a similar conversation. And through that, three artists approached me, and we're now in conversation. I've never met those artists because I wouldn't have gone to see their shows because the Fringe has too many shows, and like, how would they have gotten to me and all of the things, right? Or maybe I would hit one of them. And so for me, I agree with everything that you just said in terms of maintaining relationships and all those things, but also getting myself out somewhere else that's connected to the work, where I might meet new artists who are interested in creating work for young audiences but don't know how to get to me. It's happened a few times. And again, it's always the artistic directors or presenters at those other places who call me and say, hey, will you come do this thing? And I'm like, oh, that's really smart because it's broadening my ability to meet new artists.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's a two-way street, isn't it? Like, we're sort of the gathering stone, but it's like one wouldn't want to always think of this as being a kind of, what's the word, sort of patronising relationship, you know? It's like we are working together. We are in partnership. Mm. We've got this machine. You've got that machine, you know, all of this. Yeah. And together we can make each other's work better and bigger and brighter.
Well, that's the thing. So I'm from Runa. Scotland, so we specialise in work for undefined, and it's that space where I'm not an artist, I don't make the work, so we are fundamentally reliant on nurturing, supporting, encouraging, fostering the relationships that we have with artists who are exceptional, and they the conversations are where the ideas come from, and it's finding the right people who want to make the work. And that's the thing for me, like particularly work for that audience, you have to want to make work for babies because it's not easy. It's really special, and if you get it right, it's incredible. And I want to take people on that journey. And we try and find different ways in which to do that. So, you know, we've had conversations at drunken conversations at festivals.
Just for the podcast, she's looking at Mark from Brandon.
But it's
also
been just kind of little moments that have sparked a kind of an idea, and someone's gone away and thought for a few weeks and come back and said, actually, I have got an idea and I do want to develop that. And I mean, we make work, but we also are embedded in communities, and it's about finding ways that artists can have an ongoing relationship with very young children, their parents and carers, looking at different ways to offer really exciting moments that enrich their lives on a weekly basis, because I think that's a really important part of growing up in Scotland, is that you have a consistent contact and regular access to these experiences. And I suppose one of the things that we've been looking at in terms of sustainability is, particularly with artists coming out of pandemic, has been around actually employing artists on payroll contracts. So it's not about just constantly bouncing from one freelance contract to another. So we've got 5 artists under payroll at the moment, and some of them it's maybe 12 hours a week, some of them are full time, and that expands and contracts, but it's done in such a way that it's flexible enough for them to sort of continue to do the freelance work, the other freelance work that they might have. So we've got one artist at the moment who is performing in a show for another company, but she's effectively 3 days a week with us, but she's managed that.
Is that like an attractive thing then for artists to be on the payroll?
Big time, yeah.
There's an artist that we work with who, during the pandemic, she's employed one day a week with a theatre in North of Scotland to deliver their Pioneer Drama programme. And because of that, she was furloughed. So she had that money that sustained her during the pandemic. And it was like a penny drop moment going, why aren't we doing that?
Yeah.
We pay them, we pay freelance artists fees all the time, so why can't they have the benefit of holiday pay and sick pay and pensions and being able to get a mortgage because they've got a pay slip? You know, it's a no-brainer. If we're able to make our budgets work for a year, there's absolutely no reason why we can't be saying to those freelance artists, actually, we can pay all of you, and these are benefits. And it was quite an interesting conversation about how to bring people into that frame of mind going, this can work for you. Because I think there's a bit of hesitancy at first, because it was a sense that it might restrict, and we might be saying, well, you have to be 9 to 5, you know, Monday to Thursday. We don't. We look at annualised hours. So actually it still gives people the flexibility to work in the way that they want to work.
Which boils back down to trust and relationship again, doesn't it?
Well,
because
taught up my mantra from the beginning, communication, relationship and trust.
Yeah.
And it's a thing that I keep coming back to within the organisation, within the conversations that we're having. And it's and it goes from the audiences and the relationships we have with babies and their parents and carers, partners, artists, venues. If we haven't got transparent communication relationships and trust, then what's the point?
Great, thanks, Rona. I think that is a really interesting model. That is certainly something that addresses a lot of the problems kind of with being freelancer, you know, but gives the flexibility that an artist needs. And I think it's really great to hear the collaborative conversation as well, because again, it goes back to that power balance and who holds the money and who holds the power. And I think that's a really good wall to start breaking down, is that it is kind of a collaborative process. And and the more kind of structures that exist like that, I think the sustainability.
I mean, as the sort of heads of the organization, it also gives me the fear that, you know, we've got you know, there's all of these people who are reliant on the ongoing cycle of funding and exploration of resource and all of that kind of thing.
And we also have to keep in mind that, I think, very much like, I would imagine, like Ireland as well, that the underlying thing is that we don't have enough organisations, we don't have enough funded artists, and we don't certainly have enough to actually serve the needs of children and young people across our countries. We're not doing that. We don't have the resources. And there's the danger, in a sense, of what happens is that we're trying to actually use the resources that we have as efficiently and effectively and as imaginatively as possible. But in some senses, it potentially becomes too much, because where are those new artists that are going to be supported? Because actually what we could do with is Starcatchers being 4 or 5 times the size it is, you could actually look at models like our model at Catherine Mills and says, well, there actually needs to be 10 of them to actually effectively look at across the whole nation and buildings and all that stuff, and then look at how then they can be imaginative and actually look at that. But it's really, really difficult to be able to say, well, you can take on another 10 artists, and by the way, you're going to have to sort out your diversity, because then you're going to actually have to deal with people and artists who are working in ways that your systems don't suit. What are you going to do about that? Because actually, you might not be the organisation that's doing that, but you might be the only one that's there. So how do you then resolve that? Those questions? Because those questions have to be addressed as we go forward. Otherwise, we just end up in that situation where we're kind of trundling along and everything kind of sort of looks the same and feels the same underneath. So it's, there's that thing about how we're having conversations with ourselves, really, really sort of analysing and challenging each other and moving forward. But we're making sure that we're actually having those conversations with arts councils and governments, and actually saying, if you want to look after children in the best possible way, and we're part of that, how do we do this in a much, much more effective way than we're doing it at the moment?
Yeah, I just have a question, and it's not fully formed, but a lot of the conversation has been about artists and the precarity of that role, and parachuting, and very much resonate with that. So I'm an artist, but I've also joined Barbara as the Actual Outreach Manager, and I'm very interested in, you know, it being a parachuting experience for the schools or the educators or the children that you work with, and that often it's very hard to reconcile the two. You know, someone might be jeopardized in the mix, whether it be that the artist maybe doesn't get the full support, or the school, or the children, or you know, that balance is very hard in this project by project way of looking at things to find. So I'm curious of whether it be through a residency program or other initiatives, of how, you know, whether, well, it doesn't have to be a good experience, maybe when it's not gone well, you know, how you face the challenges in your various organizations, whether you're the artist or the institution supporting, how you've developed that relationship between an artist and a community group that you're working with in a way that serves the community from their needs up rather than at them in this parachuting way. Because it can be, you know, as someone has been on lots of sides of it, I've often found that, you know, I love for the ideal world, the children will tell you what, you know, what they want, and you manage to come in. But often people can't identify their needs, and the artists are in a vulnerable role, so they want to please the organizer, and it's a very hard balance. And you finish a project and you think, did either side get that sustainable feeling, or is it just another project by project? So maybe when you face those challenges,
I think like, I do think about it, it comes back down to relationships, you know, like there's 33 primary schools in Dublin 15. Like that's a lot of kids, you know. And we've been working with those schools over, you know, the 20 years of our existence. We've been trying to develop, like, and we're no different. And we have a children youth arts officer, but you're hoping that something lands on the in the right person's email, or you have the right number to get the right teacher or the principal is interested enough, you know. The turning point we've actually found was what when we brought an orchestra into schools. So we did this massive project. We got, I don't know, LLPPS, whatever.
Live performance there you support go. Scheme.
There you go. So we got...
I blacked out for a second.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. I keep calling the LL. You know, so we got €300,000 over the last, I don't know, year and a bit. And it was one of those classics, you know. You have to, you know, we got the first $125,000 and they want you have to spend it in 6 weeks. In the middle of a pandemic, you know, so we decided, right, we're going to... and it was around, you know, working with artists and getting money out to artists. And we thought, Jesus, how are we going to do this now? That's meaningful. So we developed an orchestra. So we sent in 29-piece orchestra into schools. So we've played to 19,000 children under the age of 12 in Dublin 15 have now had an experience of a live orchestra. It's quite an extraordinary thing. But actually what we have found is that that kind of project, what that has, and there was a whole range of supports. We sent in the orchestra, obviously, but then there was a lot of supports around it as well for teachers and for the kids. And the relationship has, we've had very good relationships at schools, but sending in the orchestra has blown their heads, you know. So it has become a very different relationship now, where now we literally send stuff out and they're going, yeah, whatever, whatever, yeah, great. So actually when an artist like Paul Curley comes along and goes, actually, during my residency, paraphrasing now, Paul, one of the things I'd really like to do is take some of my extant work that I've performed in a theatre setting and see if that would work within a school setting. So Paul comes to me with that idea. I go, great, absolutely. And Paul has been going out to schools in the area. So, and the schools develop a relationship with Paul. Yeah. Do you know, so Paul can probably pick up the phone now and go, do you know, whatever, Mary, is there any chance I can come in and can I come back and talk to the kids about how that show was and all of that, you know? It goes back to the relationship thing, you know, and the support, that key relationship between the venue and the school and the venue and the artist, and then putting those together, do you know, because there's information that we have about the schools that they'll never tell you, do you know, like, you know, don't go to that gate, it's always shut, do you know, things that would drive an artist nuts, do you know, of a Monday at 9 o'clock in the morning, do you know.
Well, I've been on the other side of that at the school, and it could be frustrating when an organisation comes and puts it on the child or the school to come up with that need, you know, in a way, rather than facilitate the need to be expressed, because it might not be in the day-to-day life or a possibility.
There's an awful lot going on in schools, yeah. You know, like there really is, like, and you know, I think schools have become so complex. They're really complex situations now, much more than even when I was going, or you know, going to school. I look at them now and thinking, you know, they have to do so much and you know, tick so many boxes, and there's so many agendas, you know. And I kind of, every time there's something on the radio and it goes, we have to go out to the schools because we need to tell them all that milk is really good and schools are the place to start, you know, it's like everything is like, it has to start with schools. They're overwhelmed, you know.
We made a piece of work with Collapsing Horse with the Ombudsman for Children and with Larkin Community School, and like the final piece was beautiful, and it was called The Rights Museum. But it was, I think, that moment, you know, kind of like what you were talking about letting go of your structure, where Dan had a plan in place on how he was going to work with the school, and like after like 2 weeks, like, this is chaos.
Yeah.
This is absolute mindless bloody violence. But then like gave himself over to it and the process, and like it just became an unbelievably fruitful experience. But
big time. But yeah, one of the confronting things was realizing just how much is going on in schools, how much the teachers' attention is being competed with and the young people's attention is being competed with. It's exactly like that. It's a kind of we need to go to schools sort of rhetoric that ends up coming into a lot of debates.
Yeah. They don't always know what they want to know because they haven't thought about it. They don't have the space, you know.
I'm conscious that we're up against in terms of time. Is there any pressing comments?
Hi, I just want to go back a bit to the point about meeting new artists and a new artist myself. So for context, I'm from Malta, and when I was living there, when I come there, I had everything was going great for me. I had my own theater company, and I had to turn down job offers because I had so many things going on. And I had done all the coffees and the coming up with ideas of the drinks and that kind of stuff. And then I decided, this is great. I'm leaving. And I think it's a cool way. And I found that I've been finding it really difficult to kind of get my foot in. And some people who might have seen me around would know that I go to everything and I do everything and I apply for all the jobs and all the residencies and everything like that. But when you're new and you're on your own, it can be so difficult. Especially this is now from kind of like a maybe community to the company kind of thing. To get your ideas across on an electronic application or something like that, you know, it's very clear. We're all artists, we like talking. We like talking about ourselves and our ideas. And sometimes just kind of filling out an online form saying, oh, I have this play I want to develop, but I've got no money, no friends who want to do the play with me, you know, that kind of thing. So this is just a prompt for people to think about, but a way to, you know, like almost like speed dating for new artists to go and meet producers and companies and kind of say, hi, I'm here, I'm looking for work, you know, if you want somebody to come in and just brainstorm plays or projects or workshops, this is what I can offer, that kind of thing. Because I don't, but personally, I know that I'm very tenacious and I'm stubborn, but it's been so difficult as someone new. So
it's
just putting that out there.
Yeah.
Well, it's a good point with you're talking about Galway, and I think you came to the worst place for that.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because we're doing this here, we're talking about these, we're having such a great week of great shows, of Mavro, but we all know when Mavro finishes, Galway will go back to what it is always. A city and a county that is well known all over the country for being this artistic place, but it's not like that. It is in the core because the artists are there. The people is willing to do the work. But we know that Galway has been wrong for years, and I'm not, like you all know, I'm not born here. I'm just, but I've been here for 20 years, I know well the place. And we all know that Galway has been wrong through personal agendas, through private businesses. So a lot is everyone in their little corners. And there's never been this network of help. The only help that I remember is it's my discount, who used to be the director of town hall, that he would put available so many times the places to rehearse, support so many times, as much as he could, because he was running, of course, a town hall theater, which is talking about profits and not about this, but he did his effort to do that. And I think it doesn't exist. That's why I think, and for many people working in children's theater, we all know that if it wasn't for Branner at this point, you know, and also all the stuff that Mehl is doing, creating this relationship with the artist that is so important, you know, it would be hard to exist, you know, because it's not there. You know, it's where when you're talking about Drio, and we all know, because I know the situation in Ireland, but we're talking about sustainability and it's all about local. And I think Galway is lacking that. And it's great that companies like Brunner, Bubble as well, and another company that sometimes people forget about it, which is an organization between the brothers of charity, which is That's Life, which is a company that's been working with people with disabilities for years. And it's been a platform for artists like me, which I specialize in that, thanks to That's Life, because they give us the space. What do you want to do? And you go, you give them a project, they say, here is the place to do it. You know, but there's very little for a city and a county, you know, that has a weight in Ireland. So very little. So I think it's good that all of this is in place, because it's the way forward. There's no other way for us, for freelance artists. That support, that relationship with the venues, with the, how many venues is in Galway? And zero support. It's not in place. You know, so I think it's, you know, it's a good point that you opened that, because I want to say, but I said, I'm going to leave it. Capital of culture. I'm not going to go into that, but that's just, you know, it's so important. And like, to hear all the projects that come. And we all know well all the support from Treeoct and how much you do, you know, and we're missing this here.
Yeah.
We're not missing it. We have it, but we could have it much bigger for what Galway it is.
Thanks,
you know.
Miguel.
If I just may add on, my name is Justina, I'm from Treeoct Festival, and I really resonate with what you were saying, because when we started our festival, it was exactly like we didn't know anything how to do things, and we started building relationships for voluntary work. So we started doing a lot of voluntary work with the organisations, just to get to know ourselves. And then when we built trust with the organisation, it was different. So networking, voluntary work, and then now we are in a situation where we're supported through Arts Council, and that we have a very strong partners in Limerick. We're from Limerick, and it's hard work, and you will not get paid for that hard work, really. You will barely survive, but you have to have a job that will support you. That will be, you know, you will build into that many years. And then, so I come from the perspective of setting up the festival and being there from the start, and also being an artist. And it took me an awful lot of time just to get even noticed or acknowledged as an artist. You know, but I could do it through my productions, through producing, through establishing that relationships. So thanks to the policy that is out there, the diversity policy, I think a lot of doors has opened, but they're just opening. I think we are all learning how to embrace that contingent that is out there. And there's a lot of hope, you know, there is a lot of hope, and we should jump on this train and just see how much we can support each other. And what can we do together? Because, like, even the Polish community is huge in Ireland, and actually, it's the second spoken language in the country. Mm-hmm. So when you think about that, how do you, in a way, how do you embrace that contingent? Not only Polish, but I'm just saying, you know, the diversity that we have. And what I liked about what Tony said is, like, get the artists from the community and get the artists to work towards the community, because the artists would know their community. So which community do you need? Which community do you want to engage? Find the artists from that community, and that work will be done, because that people will bring the audience to your venues. And essentially, this is how we started working. I said, okay, so work with me and I will bring you new audience. You know, you will have that audience in your vein. People that sometimes never came through your door because they were never thinking, this is for me, or the language barrier, or no, it's not for me, you know, I'll put on Netflix or something. I think the conversations have to be going, and yeah,
thank
a lot of voluntary work, unfortunately.
I think there's lots to continue to talk about and lots of layers of the different things that kind of could be discussed in the different ways. But I think we'll end on a note of hope, collaboration, and the intent to keep moving things forward. I just want to thank Babro for giving us the space today to have this discussion and collaboration with Mehul. You know, we are partners in that journey. Thanks to everybody here for taking part in that discussion on the panel. Matt, Dan, Emer, Kate, and Tony, thank you for those valuable contributions, and to everybody else in the room. So thanks very much.